The following presentation is brought to you by God Discussion. For a schedule of upcoming shows, please visit www.goddiscussion.net. Belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. Thomas Paine. The way to see by faith is to shut the eye of reason. Benjamin Franklin. The question before the human race is whether the God of nature shall govern the world by his own laws, or whether priests and kings shall rule it by fictitious miracles. John Adams. It is perfectly evident to my mind that there exists a necessary, eternal, supreme, and intelligent being. This is no matter of faith, but of reason. Voltaire. God gave us reason, not religion. This belief is known as deism. The World Union of Deists, which brings you this podcast, is an international organization dedicated to promoting the message of deism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of God Gave Us Reason, Not Religion, an official podcast of the World Union of Deists. I'm your host, Jason X, and with me tonight is my co-host, Tim Wingate. Howdy, Tim. How are you doing? Tim, did you drop off here? Maybe I hit the wrong button. Let's see what happens. Tim, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
All right, great. It's you playing with the mute buttons.
I guess maybe a ghost did it. I don't know.
I don't know, but I'm here.
Yeah. Okay,
here and raring to go.
Well, I'm here, too. I actually had to leave my softball game early to host this, so I hope it all goes well.
Oh, boo-hoo.
Yeah, I got one at bat, drove in a run, but I had to leave.
Okay, big question for you then. Is this a slow pitch or fast pitch?
Oh, slow pitch.
Ah,
I don't like fast spherical objects coming toward me.
Ah, okay. And Jason, the important question, especially in today's world, are you a pitcher or a catcher?
Jim, that's a very private question. I think maybe I should be the subject of an entire episode.
Just teasing, pal. Just teasing.
Well, anyway, tonight we are going to talk about what deists believe about Jesus of Nazareth. But before we get into all that, I want to mention the story of a famous deist martyr who died this month 187 years ago. According to Wikipedia, Cayetano Ripoll was a schoolmaster in Valencia, Spain, who was executed for allegedly teaching deist principles. Ripoll was a soldier in the Spanish army during the Peninsular War. He was captured by French forces and was a prisoner of war. While being held by the French, he was taken to France, and there he became aware of deism. He soon became a deist. Upon returning to Spain, he used his position as a schoolmaster to teach others about deism. He was accused by the Spanish Inquisition of being a deist and of teaching his students about deism. He was arrested for heresy and held in jail for close to 2 years. The clergymen of the Spanish Inquisition demanded Ripoll be burned at the stake for his heresy. However, the civil authorities chose to hang him instead. Allegedly, the church authorities, upset that Ripoll had not been burned at the stake, placed his body into a barrel, painted flames on the barrel, and burned it in unconsecrated ground. Other reports state that the church authorities placed his body into a barrel and burned the barrel, throwing the ashes into a river. Ripoll has the dubious honor of being the last of the many people who have been executed under the sentence from a Roman Catholic authority for having committed the act of heresy. His last words were, "I die reconciled to God and to man." That's right, folks, you heard it here first. The last person executed by the Spanish Inquisition was a deist. Cayetano Ripoll was martyred for freedom, integrity, and deism on July 26, 1826. I hope that all people, including myself, will use his example to be as honest, good, and brave as they can be. Do you have any thoughts, Tim?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, Jason. Thank you. You know, Rapal, Jesus, Galileo, and another gentleman, martyr, that I'd like to mention, Michael Servetus, were all called heretics and traitors. And what we need to understand is this concept of heresy, how it relates to treason, and how reason is involved in all in these two things as well. Heresy, treason, and reason, and what's happening in our world today. Heresy is just very simply an opinion or a doctrine that is different from the established religious belief. It can also mean a different or a controversial or unorthodox opinion or doctrine in politics, philosophy, or science. A heretic is somebody who adheres to these different opinions. So what we see is that heresy, especially in those days that we're looking back at where you did not have a separation between church and state, if you departed from the faith of the state, you were in treason to the crown. And we have many instances when, if you remember your English history, you had the crown bouncing back and forth between being Catholic and Protestant, Catholic and Protestant. And various times, various people were being burned or having capital punishment put against them, executed, because they were of the wrong faith or holding to the wrong faith positions. We have a very famous trial that had to do with, I believe it was William Penn, if I'm not mistaken, being a Quaker. And out of that came the jury nullification doctrine, that if the law is a bad law, the jury has a right to nullify the law by letting the accused person go free. But this is what heresy is, and why heresy is such a pernicious, terrible, bad concept, because you can have a heretic or somebody who's committing heresy, even if they're going against the popular political position. And we have that guy, Edward Snowden, who's running around. Of course, you have Julian Assange. These are simply people who have exposed what the governments have been doing, and they're considered traitors, and they're bad because they have brought to light some of the evil and the wrong things that governments are doing. So in effect, they're applying the same kind of concept of heresy, but in a, we'll call it a secular view, although it is, in my view, it's a secular religion. They will apply that to these people. And this is where heresy and treason go hand in hand. And the only way to counteract this is by the use of reason. And this is where it's important to understand what reason is. We all reason. The question is, how well do we reason? We all have learned how to think, but thinking is just pretty much self-awareness. You know, Rene Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. And if you don't know who Rene Descartes is, he's the one who is basically considered the father of modern philosophy. Reasoning is the art of thinking toward an objective, like a problem solving or decision making. And there are three basic forms of reasoning. And they're important today because, folks, our subject is about reasoning about the existence of Jesus. And there are three different forms, and as we continue with the program, think about these three different kinds of forms of reasoning. The first one is deductive reasoning. It starts out with a general statement or a hypothesis, examines the possibilities to reach a specific logical conclusion. Basically, the scientific method uses deduction to test hypotheses and theories and come to a conclusion. A good example would be is this, all men are mortal. Jason is a man. Therefore, Jason is mortal.
Jason is a manly man.
A manly man with beautiful eyes. For deductive reasoning to be sound, the hypothesis must be correct. It is assumed, and you remember that old thing, Jason, you teach English, if I remember correct, something to that effect, or you've been involved in English. You ever taken written out the word assume and then through the slashes, and pointed out that if assuming things makes an ass out of you and me? You ever done that? Put the slashes on either side.
I learned that from my football coach.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So even in deductive reasoning, it's assumed that the premises that in this case all men are mortal and Jason is a man are true. Therefore, the conclusion can be logical and true. There's exceptions to this, and we won't quite get into all those things. But the next form of reasoning is inductive reasoning, and that's the opposite of deductive. Inductive reasoning basically makes a broad generalization from some specific observations. Even if all these premises are true in a statement, inductive reasoning allows for the conclusion to be false. Here's an example. Harold is a grandfather. Harold is bald. Therefore, all grandfathers are bald. The conclusion does not follow logically, though, from the statement, because not all grandfathers are bald.
Mm-hmm.
Inductive reasoning has its place in the scientific method. It's needed. You take these generalized statements, you create a hypothesis, and then you use deductive reasoning to test that hypothesis to make sure that what you're thinking through is correct and all the evidence is there that points toward the conclusion that you want to make. Now, the third form of reasoning is called abductive reasoning. It's based on making and testing hypotheses using the best information available. It may not be good information, may not be good evidence, but you take the evidence that you got, the information you got, and you create a hypothesis, and you still try to test it. It often entails making an educated guess after observing a phenomenon where there's no real clear explanation. Abductive reasoning is useful for forming hypotheses to be tested. That's the important part of this, because as we will see later, a lot of the claims for the historical accuracy or the historical Jesus are actually abductive reasoning, but seldom are they ever tested, these ideas and concepts. Now, doctors use abductive reasoning when they're trying to make a diagnosis based on test results and symptoms. Jurors will make it. Use abductive reasoning based on the evidence that's been presented to them. So what I'd like you folks out there who are listening to do is think about these three forms of reasoning and which one's being used in the three articles that Jason is going to share with us about whether or not Jesus existed, and if he did, how did he exist, etc. So are the initial premises true? Are the hypotheses logical and tested? And are the conclusions logical and true? And back
all
to
right,
you, Jason.
Thank you for giving us all the information, Tim. You are certainly a logician. As I said before, tonight we're going to talk about what deists believe about Jesus of Nazareth, and here is how I plan to do it. I've got three short articles here written by three different deists. The first one was written by me, and it argues that Jesus was a real person who got mythologized. The second article was written by Stephen Van Eck. It argues that Jesus was not a real person. He was just a mythological being. And the third article is actually just three quotations from Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson believed that Jesus was not only a real person, but that he was a deist whose teachings and biography were warped by some of his followers. Jefferson thinks more highly of the quote-unquote real Jesus than I do. I will keep reading the aforementioned articles until Tim or some brave caller interrupts me. Please, 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 Tim and listeners, interrupt me frequently to give us your opinions about Jesus of Nazareth. Does that sound good, Tim?
Oh, yeah. No problem.
All right. Then, without further ado, I will start. And here comes maybe the greatest article ever written, A Probable Explanation of Jesus Christ by Jason X.
Okay.
You heard the greatest story ever told? Here's the greatest article ever told. How can we get a fairly accurate understanding of whom Jesus of Christ really was? We can rely heavily on the writings, which is generally considered by most modern scholars to be the oldest still existing biography of Jesus, that is the Gospel of Mark, and use a lot of skepticism. After all, Jesus is not the only human being in history to be mythologized into a superhuman miracle worker. St. Nicholas of Myra in Lycia, born around 270 AD, died in 343 AD, was a real person who is now mythologized into Santa Claus, an obese old man who miraculously keeps track of the moral character of children, travels around the earth on a sleigh pulled by flying reindeer, visits millions of houses in one night without opening any door or window, and leaves presents for millions of children. A similar process happened to Jesus. He was a real person, Jesus of Nazareth, who was mythologized into a make-believe person, Jesus Christ, an even greater miracle worker than Santa Claus. Another reason to use skepticism when theorizing about the life of the real Jesus is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. As far as I know, there is no compelling scientific evidence that the miracles ascribed to Jesus happened, or that any similar miracles ever happened in all of history. Such miracle stories are indeed extraordinary claims without extraordinary proof. Therefore, we should not believe them. All of this having been said, something like the following is probably the truth about the man known as Jesus Christ. Jesus was born in Nazareth, Galilee, between 7 and 2 BCE. That means before the Christian era, and lived there until he was a young man, working as a carpenter. His mother was Mary, and his father was Joseph or some other man. He had brothers and sisters. The word Messiah means the anointed one, because Jewish priests, prophets, and kings often began their respective offices after being anointed with oil that was supposedly holy. Many Jews during the time of Jesus believed that God would send a special Messiah, the capital M Messiah, to liberate them and their land from foreign rule. The Messiah would also begin the Messianic Age, a time of peace and brotherhood on earth, without crime, war, and poverty. Christ comes from the Greek word for Messiah, Christos. Thus, Christ is not Jesus' last name. It is a title given to him by Christians, expressing their belief that Jesus is the Messiah. A man called John the Baptist taught that people should repent and be baptized so that their sins would be forgiven by God. He also preached that the Messiah would come and baptize with the Holy Spirit, which is a far greater baptism than John could do. Perhaps this literal and or metaphorical baptism was supposed to convey what Galatians chapter 5, verse 22 calls the fruit of the Spirit. That's the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Qualities needed for and indicative of the Messianic Age. Jesus left Nazareth to learn about God, serve God, and make the world a better place, travel a little, and have some fun. He became a disciple of John, and John baptized him. Eventually, John was arrested and beheaded by King Herod's soldiers because he was openly critical of the king and inclined many citizens toward rebellion. Jesus interpreted the arrest and beheading as a sign that God would now reveal the Messiah to humanity because the Messiah's herald had accomplished his mission, preparing the Jews for the Messiah. John could do no more preparing now that he was dead. Likewise, many Jewish men before and after him, like many Jewish men before and after him, Jesus suspected that he himself was the Messiah, began to gather his own disciples, preach with a very authoritative style, and tried to do miracles. Many people liked his preaching and concluded that he actually did miracles. This made him very popular with many Jews, and the stories of his supposed miracles began to be embellished even in his own lifetime. The Pharisees were an influential group of Jews who wanted all Jews to live according to the ritualistic commandments of their version of Judaism. But Jesus taught that those commandments could be violated when it was more humane or convenient to do so. This angered the Pharisees, so they sought to have Jesus executed by King Herod, who also disliked Jesus because Jesus was like John the Baptist. Jesus would periodically debate with Pharisees and other Jews on religious topics for close to the remainder of his life, making deadly enemies in the process. Jesus' lifelong friends and family generally believed he was insane. That's right, folks. Jesus' lifelong family generally believed that he was insane. If you don't believe me, look at Mark chapter 3, verse 21. That's Mark chapter 3, verse 21. And many Jewish religious experts attributed his miracles to the power of Satan. You can check out Mark chapter 3, verse 22 to see proof of that. Jesus preached and tried to work miracles all around Galilee, but the people of his hometown rejected him as a holy man, let alone the Messiah. Jesus then sent out his own disciples in groups of two to preach and try to work miracles, perhaps imitating a similar practice of John the Baptist, his religious mentor. Jesus preached and tried to work miracles in Phoenicia and Decapolis. Gradually, he began to convince many of his disciples that he was the Messiah, and he promised that some people living at that time would live to witness the Messianic age. See Mark chapter 9, verse 11 for that evidence. This means that Jesus was wrong. Every human alive then is now dead. Jesus preached and tried to work miracles in Judea. Then he went to Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish people, riding on a young donkey to fulfill a Messianic prophecy, which can be found in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. Many Jews in and around Jerusalem had heard of Jesus by this time and were willing to greet him as the Messiah. They spread their clothes on the road and cut down leafy branches from the trees and spread them on the road. Then those who went before and those who followed cried out saying, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the kingdom of our father, David, who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." This comes from Mark chapter 11, verses 8 through 10. This exclamation means something like the following: "Save us now, God, to the Messiah. Holy is he who comes in the name of God. Holy is Israel, which was founded by God through our first king David. Jesus is the new David. Jesus is the Messiah. Save us now, God, through the Messiah." The visit, which culminated at the supposedly sacred temple of Jerusalem, was dangerous to do because of the Roman and Jewish authorities. The Romans did not want a supposed Messiah to lead the Jews in a revolt, and the Jewish authorities did not want a Jewish revolt to be brutally crushed by the Romans. Because of the danger to himself, Jesus spent the night outside of Jerusalem in nearby Bethany. Jesus returned to Jerusalem the next day and tried to act like the Messiah once again. He drove out those who bought and sold things in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple, saying to them, "Is it not written in the Jewish holy writings, 'My house should be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of thieves"? See Mark chapter 11, verses 15 through 17 for that information. Many of the Jewish religious leaders now sought to kill Jesus because many Jews were astonished at his teaching. Astonished means that they could have been scandalized that Jesus was rejecting the well-established money-making procedures of the temple, and or they could have been astonished that Jesus spoke and acted with such authority and eloquence that he really seemed like the Messiah. In any case, Jesus knew that he had placed himself in even more danger this time, so he once again spent the night in Bethany. Jesus continued to teach his religious ideas. Quote, "Have faith in God and prayer. Whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you will receive them, and you will have them. You also need to be forgiven." End quote. I did a little bit of paraphrasing there. That comes from Mark chapter 11, verses 22 through 26. Soon after disrupting the temple, perhaps the next day, Jesus returned, and many of the Jewish religious leaders asked him, "By what authority are you doing these things?" But Jesus cleverly evaded the question and began to preach, telling a parable that basically said, "God is good, but you are evil. That is why you and your kind killed all the prophets. I am the Messiah. I am the Messiah, and you will try to kill me too." These religious leaders would have arrested Jesus right then, but too many Jews who supported Jesus were watching and listening. The religious leaders in Jerusalem were often thought by the average Jew to be collaborators with the despised Romans, seeking to maintain their positions. Therefore, the average Jew favored popular, charismatic religious figures who opposed the religious establishment, figures such as Jesus. Many were impressed with Jesus' wise and evasive response to the Pharisees and the Herodians about paying taxes to Caesar, as a response to the Sadducees about Jesus' doctrine of the resurrection from the dead. The bottom line was that Jesus won the battle of words between himself and those who wanted to discredit him. In fact, Jesus started converting some of the Jewish scribes. Then he kept on preaching in the temple, confounding and sharply criticizing the religious leaders, proclaiming himself the Messiah and praising generosity. This made most of the Jewish religious leaders hate and fear him all the more. Jesus predicted that the Messianic age would follow difficulties such as had never been seen since the beginning of creation. Wars, earthquakes, famine, the sun, moon, and stars losing their light, and other troubles. No one but God knew exactly when this would happen, but it would happen during this generation. That comes from Mark chapter 13, verse 30. Once again, this means that Jesus was wrong. Everyone from that generation is long dead, and the Messianic age has not begun. One of Jesus' leading disciples, Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and promised to give them Jesus for money. Judas probably did not believe at this time that Jesus was the Messiah and hoped to make some money by betraying him. Judas led the chief priests and their helpers to arrest Jesus at night in Bethany, when the multitudes who favored Jesus would be elsewhere asleep. With a high priest presiding and the chief priests and many scribes attending, Jesus was found guilty at a secret trial for falsely claiming to be the Messiah. The next morning, Jewish religious leaders had Jesus brought before Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea. Their goal was to have Jesus legally executed. Probably there was an ongoing agreement between the Roman governor and the Jewish priests. The Jewish priests could keep their prestigious jobs and protect their people from Roman punishment to a large degree if they turned over all Jews who claimed to be the Messiah. The Romans agreed to this because they wanted to rule Judea with as little trouble as possible. Pilate had Roman soldiers mock, beat, and crucify Jesus for sedition in order to prove that Jesus was not the Messiah and to discourage Jews from rebelling. The Romans wanted the Jews to have no king but Caesar. That is why the sign that was placed above Jesus while he was being crucified said, "The King of the Jews," meaning, this is what will happen to a Jew who tries to be king of Judea without Roman approval. Simon of Cyrene probably had to help Jesus carry his cross. Jesus was probably crucified with two thieves, and the Roman soldiers probably gambled for Jesus' clothes because clothing was so valuable back then. On the cross, Jesus asked why God had forsaken him. Perhaps he finally realized that he was a fool and not the Messiah. Many of his female followers watched the execution, probably moved by great affection and feeling, safer than Jesus' male disciples. Men, after all, are more likely to be arrested and executed for sedition than women. An admirer of Jesus, Joseph of Arimathea, paid for the false Messiah's burial and tomb. Mary Magdalene was a crazy woman. Seven demons were supposedly exorcised from her, a disciple of Jesus. You can read about the exorcism of the demons in Mark chapter 16, verse 9. She told many of Jesus' grieving disciples that Jesus appeared to her alive. After that, Jesus supposedly appeared in another form to two of the disciples as they walked and went into the country. Many of Jesus' disciples were grieving largely because they'd invested so much money, hope, time, self-esteem, and effort into following him, believing he was the Messiah. They did not want to be proven fools, and they were very eager to be proven right. They were so eager, in fact, that they were willing to believe the testimony of a crazy woman, Mary Magdalene, and two other disciples who said Jesus was alive, but that he looked like a different man. I hate to point out the obvious, For the reason that the living man did not look like the dead Jesus was that the living man and the dead Jesus were two different people. Duh. Around.
Really?
Yeah, well, that's my theory at least.
All
around
right.
The aforementioned probable facts. I'm almost done here.
Okay.
Around the aforementioned probable facts, and I emphasize the word probable facts because my assertions are educated guesses, developed many related myths and traditions about Jesus, including the teachings that Jesus appeared to the 11 apostles, the 12 leading disciples minus Judas Iscariot, gave them the Great Commission, and then ascended into heaven. The ascension conveniently explains why the resurrected Jesus can no longer be seen. Jesus died between 26 and 36 CE, that means common era, and his bones still live in or around the Middle East. But the religion he accidentally started has spread throughout the world and is still vibrant. All right, Tim.
All right. I got
Let's
a question for you.
Sure.
How do you know somebody named Mark wrote that gospel? By the way, I must throw in, you did a nice compilation and condensing of running through the book of Mark. But how do you know?
You know, I don't know. And neither does anyone else alive today.
No. Also, do we have an original copy
of the Gospel of Mark?
Yeah.
I don't know. There are fragments, but the oldest copy of Mark doesn't even have the story of the resurrection.
No. In fact, the oldest fragment is we don't even know that it's an original. It's a copy of something written by somebody. But even at the very beginning of the book of Mark, doesn't even claim it's Mark writing it. We have no idea who it is. In fact, the names attributed to the Gospels were made up. They were attributed to them sometime in the 300s.
Maybe the 200s. I'm going to talk to callers, okay? Keep on going.
Oh, okay, great.
Preach on, brother. Preach on. Witness. Testify.
So what we have here is a problem with right off the bat, taking and making a condensation of this book of Mark without actually critically looking at and reasoning. You know, you can make some, you know, you called it an educated guess, or not even educated guess. I'm sorry, Jason, because the education is assuming that the so-called Bible scholars are actually telling the truth. The fact is, we have no original documents. We have no original writings, period, for any of the Gospels. Christianity, you know, on these four biographies, as you call them, so supposed biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that are included in the New Testament, Christianity must stand or fall. Now, you can take this story. I mean, we can take the story of St. Nicholas, now, just as you mentioned, and you can take this Jesus story, and you're claiming that he was mythologized. But he's mythologized in the book of Mark. It's not afterwards. The book of Mark itself in the New Testament mythologizes Jesus, attributes miracles to him, says that supposedly Mary Magdalene had seven demons cast out of her. How would these people know? Who would know? How would we even have any evidence, any evidentiary claim for that? Not only that, but you get into how much of the book of Mark is accurate, is all true. How much? Because you get to that last chapter, 16, and from verses 17 on, you have an interpolation. And folks, what an interpolation is basically an addition. It's the introduction of new or false material into a document. New or incorrect material into a document. We find this throughout the New Testament, and especially in the Gospels, the book of this so-called book of Mark, there's verses that were added in. There were verses that were put in out of all the various manuscripts there are. There's all kinds of marginal notes that have been inserted in, and then over time, as since they didn't have movable type in the printing press, people were actually copying these things by hand. Quite often, you would have a scribe decide to reword something because he didn't like the way it was worded. And the reason they didn't like the way it was worded was because you had different factions of so-called Christians jockeying for power throughout the Middle East. I've talked about this before, if you've been listening to the program, about this wonderful book that is by Jenkins, which is called The Jesus Wars. And the Jesus Wars actually – go ahead, Jason.
I hate to interrupt, but we have a coincidence here. There's a guy named Mark. I'm not kidding. There's a guy named Mark. He's calling in, and he has some input to the show. Is this a good time to let Mark speak?
Oh, sure. Let's go ahead. I can talk anytime.
All right. Here we go. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Can you hear me? Hi, hello.
Yes, we can.
Yep.
We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Great.
Well, go ahead.
All right. Hey, hi, guys. Sorry about that. Hey, you guys know me. This is the
Deist Reality.
Yes.
Yeah, we've talked to you before. We have good thoughts of you.
All right, I have some echoing going on here, so I'm sorry about that. I'm using both the Skype and the other one. So, do you hear echoing now?
No, we don't hear
it.
Maybe you should turn one down.
All right, I did. So I hear it. Really sounds good right now. Hey, this is a great conversation, guys. I think of myself personally. Think of Jesus like I would Braveheart, the movie Braveheart.
Oh, very good.
You know,
William Wallace.
Yes, for me, it doesn't necessarily need to be a real character at all. I think the stuff that he taught us, or the words that are found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which of course there are no originals, there never were, and that's why at the title of each head it says the gospel according to Matthew or according to Mark. We don't know who this according to person is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he did teach us, and we as pure deists have a right to our own interpretation of this Bible. It's just as much our book as it is anybody's. And our interpretations of this book is just as valid as anybody's. And we've done, and of course you guys know, and Jason, I know you being an ex-priest, and we know it pretty well as well. So our interpretations of it are just as valid is what I'm getting at. And Jesus,
a lot of times, atheists, agnostics, and deists know the Bible better than Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. And a lot of them don't realize
that. I mean, I might still be a Christian if I hadn't gone to seminary. I went to seminary, I learned all this stuff, and I analyzed the Bible, and I came up with, you know, I learned about contradictions and evil teachings, and I thought, holy cow, I can invent a better religion than this. So I just followed my own philosophy.
Yeah, right. And it's just amazing how, I mean, Jesus told us that we are the sons and daughters of God. And that's kind of a neat simile to think of God as our father or our mother. And
Mark, I when you came on, I was just trying to talk about the book of Mark and pointing out, you know, it's wonderful that we want to talk about the good philosophies that we find in the New Testament and specifically in the Gospels. And a lot of these wonderful words that are attributed to Jesus are good things, such as, you know, the golden rule.
The golden rule.
Okay,
yeah.
Do unto others as you have them do unto you. You know, treat people the way that you want to be treated. You know, some of these kinds of things that, you know, love one another. These are all good ideas. They're not unique or original with Jesus. They've been echoed throughout various civilizations by philosophers as well. The problem is we just don't know who actually wrote in these stories. And like you said, you're attributing them to, well, let's say maybe Jesus is, this character Jesus is a compilation person. You referred to William Wallace in Braveheart. I think actually William Wallace was a true person. The movie, of course, was fictionalized based on a novel. I think the character that Mel Gibson played that you're thinking of as a compilation character was The Patriot, the movie The Patriot that had Heath Ledger in it as his son. Right. That one we know was a compilation figure from various characters from the American Revolution. Now, if Jesus is a compilation figure, as you're suggesting, and that's great, that's fine, but to use the Gospels as some, well, as gospel, as it's been used, to me that's just kind of disingenuous, because it's made up.
Yeah, I would agree, but there are truths to be found. There, you know.
Oh, I agree. The philosophical truths, absolutely.
Right.
The good teaching.
I'll even go a step further. mythology can be very helpful.
Amen.
And a lot of times when I go through a hard time, I think about Jesus. I was raised a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, okay, here's a guy who, at least in the story, was a good person, and he just kept on going until he was killed by evil people. And sometimes that's how I feel. But that's not the only mythology I like. I also like the Odyssey. I live far away from home. Life has taken me far away. I miss home. I miss my family. But like Odysseus, I'm going to keep on plucking along until things work out.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if not Jesus, then why not Hercules?
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of the things in Hercules' life parallel that of Jesus.
Well, that's what I meant when I brought up Jesus as a character. I think that we can learn from all these myths and legends. And, you know, the Christian may think that it's a bad thing to call Christianity mythology, but in a lot of respects, it's not a bad thing to call Christianity.
It is mythology. See, that's the point. It has been mythologized.
Right, it is. But people take it, of course, we know, as literal truth or inherent, and we know that it isn't. It can't be, because God doesn't make books. We know that.
Yeah.
God gave us a brain, not a book.
Right.
By the way, Mark, we really like you. I really like your work on the website there, the Facebook page.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
On YouTube or Facebook?
I'm thinking the Facebook. Didn't you say it's real? It's real deism.
Oh, Deist Reality. Yeah.
Deist Reality. That's the one. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you're the guy who does some of those YouTube videos, right?
Yes, I tried it.
Do you have a goatee?
I don't at this time. No, it's summer, so I kind of shaved it off.
But on some of the YouTube videos, are you a bald guy with a goatee?
And I usually wear a hat with DS Reality with a goatee, yes.
There you go. That's okay. Who I thought you were. Well, good to meet you. I'm glad you called.
Yeah.
And actually, Mark, you gave a great segue for the next article, and I'm going to read it as soon as I ask you this question. Is there anything else you want to add at this time before I read the next article?
No, go ahead. I'm just enjoying listening to you guys.
Okay, great.
Thanks,
what I'm
going
to do, Mark, because I respect you so much, I'm going to leave the microphone on at least for now. And if you want to interrupt me, you go ahead. So say, hey, Jason, I got this thought here.
Okay, thank you.
All right, here comes an article called "Was Jesus Real?" It's by Stephen Van Eck. You can find it on the World Union of Deists website. If you want to
which
look
is,
like a lunatic,
which is Jason?
Oh, which is www.deism.com. That's www.deism.com. Which reminds me, I should probably do like a station identification or something like this. Hello, once again, this is Jason X here along with my co-host Tim Wingate. I am the Deputy Director of the World Union of Deists. We'd love to have you call in at 914-338-0452 or 888-238-8529. Please only use the 888 number for a quick phone call because it costs God discussion more money than the 914 number.
The World Union of Deists is an educational organization dedicated to teaching the world about deism so that humanity will be as sane, good, and happy as possible. Our website address is www.deism.com. That's www.deism.com. All right, back to the article. If you want to look like a lunatic or an idiot to the average Christian, there's no better way than to claim that Jesus never existed. They'll look at you like you sprouted a new head. But if you hold your ground and can back it up, these same Christians can be sent their way flummoxed. Here are the three essential arguments supporting the claim of non-existence. One, the lack of historical evidence that this crowd-drawing, wonder-working sensation ever existed. Two, the suspicious similarity of the Jesus story to that of earlier mystery cult godmen who were born of virgins on December 25th, who died on a tree, and who rose from the dead. And three, the consistent distortion of Old Testament passages that are alleged prophecies, and the strong indication that many of the details of the gospel stories were simply concocted to match what those passages seem to suggest. The last two arguments are highly specialized and need a lot of research and preparation to fully defend. But when it comes to the first one, all you need to do is establish that you're not a lone wacko, as some might assume. Fact is, many scholars have come to the same conclusion, something most Christians are completely oblivious to. Many scholars have undertaken the quest for the historical Jesus, and they've come up empty, if they're intellectually honest. Albert Schweitzer, for one, wrote a similarly titled book in 1906. Here is his conclusion, quote, "The question which has so much exercised the minds of men, whether Jesus was a historic Christ, is answered in the sense that everything the historical Jesus is, everything that is said of him, everything that is known of him, belongs to the world of the imagination, that is, the imagination of the Christian community, and therefore he has nothing to do with any man who belongs in the real world." End quote. Schweitzer was not alone. Here's what another scholar, G.R.S. Mead, wrote. "It has always been an unfailing source of astonishment to the historical investigator of Christian beginnings that there is not a single word from the pen of any pagan writer of the first century of our era which in any fashion be referred to the marvelous story recounted by the gospel writers. The very existence of Jesus seems unknown." Or taking a patriotic tack, you might cite the redoubtable Thomas Paine, who made the following determination in a supplement to his Age of Reason. Quote, "These repeated forgeries and falsifications create a well-founded suspicion that all the cases spoken of concerning the person called Jesus Christ are made cases on purpose to lug in, and that very clumsily, some broken sentences from the Old Testament and apply them as prophecies of those cases, and that so far from his being the Son of God, he did not even exist as a man, that he is merely an imaginary or allegorical character, as Apollo, Hercules, Jupiter, and all the deities of antiquity were. There is no history written at the time Jesus is said to have lived that speaks of the existence of any of such a person, even as a man." End quote. Some of the leading Protestant theologians, though unable to let go of their attachment to Jesus, were still honest enough to admit that there's no real evidence of him. Rudolf Bultmann concluded that Christianity is based on the legendary Jesus, not the historic one, and that the historic one was unrecoverable. Quote, "I do indeed think that we can now know almost nothing concerning the life and personality of Jesus, since the early Christian sources show no interest in either and are, moreover, fragmentary and often legendary." End quote. Paul Tillich came to a similar conclusion. Quote, "Historical research has made it obvious that there is no way to get at the historical events which produce the biblical Jesus who is called the Christ with more than a degree of probability." End quote. What this amounts to is sheer guesswork for those who maintain this irrational belief. Mediocre apologists who've read the ever-popular Josh McDowell books are fond of touting historical evidence for Jesus. Don't let them get away with this. This supposed evidence always turns out to be non-contemporaneous, as in Tacitus's second century reference to Christians, which does nothing to prove that there was an actual Christ, and especially Josephus, who not only was born at the putative time of Christ, but whose purported mention of him has been determined by scholars, not pious apologists, to be an interpolation. The arguments in defense of this are overly technical for an impromptu oral discussion. But for us, the conclusion is inescapable. Jesus never existed. It might shock the average Christian, but as you see, it's not so ridiculous an assertion after all. Proclaim with confidence and frustrate a soul winner. Now he ends, that's Van Eck, ends his article with recommended reading. The Jesus Mysteries by Timothy Freck and Peter Gandy. And here is an excellent one. I've read this book. Excellent. It completely disproves Christianity, and it's very well written. Can Christians prove the resurrection? A reply to the apologist by Chris Sandoval, and Gospel Fictions by Randall Helms. Gentlemen, start your replies.
Go ahead, Mark, if you're there.
Yes. Can you hear me, guys? Still?
Sure.
Yeah.
Go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was great. You know, Thomas Paine in his Age of Reason also said that nothing that is here said can apply even with the most distant disrespect to the real character of Jesus Christ. He was a virtuous and an ambient man, the morals, and, you know, he goes on just to say how he was a great teacher. And, of course, Thomas Paine, he had a respect for the Bible. What he hated was the wrongful interpretation of these Trinitarian, original sinner, type Christians who warp the true meaning of all these books that have been compiled to mean something they don't mean. You know, they knew how to break these books down, like Psalms and all these different books, into what they, you know, what these people who actually wrote them, whoever they were, probably some person on, you know, some spiritual journey writing the Psalms, different people. And
well, yeah, it's been proven. I mean, all you have to do is be somebody who's used to, you know, be one of these, I can't think of the word, literary scientists, I guess, would be you can tell different styles of writing, and we know that the Psalms are compilations, you know, this kind of thing. Same thing with the New Testament, same thing with a lot of the so-called, you know, the 13 books or so that are attributed to the Apostle Paul. He did maybe 8 of them. So,
yeah.
I want to interrupt here. I respectfully disagree with what Mark said because, well, I'll agree with Mark that there's some good teachings in the Bible, but I will say that there's some evil teachings in the Bible. The problem is not misinterpreting what the writer meant. The problem is interpreting incorrectly and living according to it. And I got a passage here which is one of the most blatantly evil teachings of the Bible. It's Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 28 through 29, which sanctions the raping of female virgins. That's right, the Bible sanctions the raping of female virgins.
Okay, well, wait a minute, Jason, though. Did Jesus endorse that particular passage in the Old Testament?
I think you're setting me up, Tim. But didn't he say not the law and the prophets, he didn't come to abolish them but to fulfill them?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, again, we have to know that Jesus never said anything. Because he never wrote a single word, so
that's right.
You know what I mean? So
all right.
Hey, I mean, come on, guys. This is still like arguing over whose version of Santa Claus are you going to believe, Thomas Nash or Clements or
yeah,
Coca Cola's.
You know the beauty about us guys? We're not telling anybody you're going to go to hell if you don't believe the Bible the way I understand it. You know,
well, that's
not
true.
You know, we're not. I'm not going to say if you don't. You know, you don't believe. You know, the. You know, I'm just saying it's a book, like any book that holds some truth. I'm not saying you get what you. You know. Sometimes they say when you read a book, you have a different understanding of it the next time you read it. That happens to me all the time with the Bible because it's so darn complex in so many different ways that, of course, the older you get or. The more you read into different words, the more it changes on you. So, in that respect,
right?
Like
well, let me read these words to you and see how you interpret them. This is Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 28 through 29. If a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her, and they are found, then the man who lay with her shall give to the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has violated her. He may not put her away all his days. So, you know, if you were an ugly Israelite man, mm-hmm. and you see some young, hot Israelite virgin, doesn't have to be an Israelite, can be any young, hot virgin, all you got to do is rape her, and then you pay the father some shekels, and hey, you got yourself a hot wife for life. That's a deal, people.
Yeah,
I don't mean that. I'm being facetious, obviously.
It is. Yeah. It's disgusting. There's a lot of stuff in it. Moses was worse than Hitler because he used God as a tool to justify
yeah.
his annihilation. So let's not give Moses.
Yeah, I would like to just try and stay on the issue of Jesus because we could
all
spend
right.
a
yeah.
lot of time ripping on the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But
well,
the question of whether or not
Jesus
existed.
Jesus in the New Testament taught that God will take a large portion of humanity and burn them alive in hell forever. Now, I don't care
That's
how
right.
evil you are in this life, you don't deserve to be burned alive forever. And if God is completely good, God's going to figure out a way not to burn a sentient creature alive.
Well, that's your interpretation of what God is. Maybe God is evil and bad. Maybe the Gnostics were correct that he's insane, at least specifically Jehovah.
Well, you know what? That is a possibility. But I would say that God created us creatures, and so God probably is better than us creatures at everything that is excellent. For example, God is probably stronger than the strongest man. God is probably smarter than the smartest.
I don't know how probable that is. I mean, what do you base that on?
Well, would you tell me that? Is it inductive, deductive, or abductive? And if you say abductive, you have to tell me what that means again.
You know, I think it's basically abductive because it's based on making. You're creating a hypothesis, and I'm testing it. You're making educated guesses after observing phenomenons for maybe where there's no clear explanation, and that's, you know, we've got these writings of these people who supposedly are telling us a story about this God man who, and so you're relying on some unsubstantiated evidence, and that is the New Testament, to create your theory or your idea of what God may or may not be like, and so we need to test it. So, yeah, I'd have to say it's abductive.
Yeah, well, please define
abductive. Wait. Define abductive for me.
Oh, abductive is...
I kind of daydreamed when you first did it.
Basically, what it is it entails making an educated guess after observing phenomenon for which there is no clear explanation. It's basically
when it comes
the forming of a hypothesis to be tested.
Right, and when it comes to God, God is very mysterious. So basically, all we got is speculation. So I got to think to myself: is God completely good or not? And just my best guess is that God is, at least compared to any human being I ever met.
Right, best guess. And what I would like to just kind of emphasize here is about the New Testament is that it is one – we're just going to throw the whole New Testament in together as one book hypothesized to be written by someone who knew Jesus and 26 authors – by people who didn't know anyone who knew Jesus. And all of this occurred in different places over 300 years before being voted on and then disseminated. Then 1,300 years later, a new compilation translated, retranslated, and then retranslated over the next 200 years, we now have the Bible, or the New Testament that we are using today.
Yes, here's and, the evidence that it's worse.
Too much error, too much room for error.
Yeah. Here's the evidence that it's worse. Thomas Paine, in his Age of Reason, says it so perfectly.
Thank you. I was going to get into that, but you go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's first of all, it's a revelation that we're not obligated to believe because it wasn't made to us personally. So we're not obligated to believe it. in like manner that, let's say, Moses or even Jesus, who received the revelations first and forehand, if he did. Doesn't matter if he did or he didn't. I didn't receive it. I don't believe in a devil. I don't believe that our Creator would create such a thing. And why would he? If you really examine the whole devil concept, you find an imperfect God. I think as deists, we make one claim, and that is that God is. And that's our only claim. And even the God, I realize it's unfair to the atheist and agnostic, because the word God does imply intelligence. But in the same respect, it's a respectful title to give whatever it is that we come from. You know, it's right to give this force, this power, this energy, an honorary title of some kind. And I think God should be that title that is open-ended. It has different meanings for different people.
That's true, it does today, even though it is of Teutonic origin.
Right. And I think
the Teutonic tribal god, yeah.
I think a lot of people are getting that part of it as far as, you know, it could be an acronym, grow or die.
You know, or
grand old designer or something of this, you know, and I think, Thomas Paine, he had some great thoughts when he said, we are all deists who believe in a deity. I don't have the exact words here, but he was talking about.
He said that this is what all Christians have in common is that they start off with the basic belief that God exists.
Yeah, or not just Christians, everybody.
Yeah, all religions.
You know, all of us, even atheists, know we come from something.
Yeah.
I've been doing some studying. I think you saw my the Unbelievers video, Jason, that I did with atheism, and I realize it's in your face kind of video. I'm getting off the whole Jesus thing here, I guess, and I shouldn't do that.
That's all right. Well, you will give you some time.
You know, I think we can all unite under this force, whatever it is, and we can all be atheist about it, meaning that this force doesn't play a conscious, active role in our life. Atheism, that's the true sense of the word. Or a theist that got believing in providence and stuff like this. Or agnostic. I can go through the course of a day and have these feelings any part of the day, whether God, sometimes I think he is, sometimes or she is, and sometimes I think he isn't, you know? But we're not obligated to believe it.
You got a good point there, Mark.
You know,
hey, Jason,
I
was just looking at the time here. You got a commercial set up? If not,
no. You know what? We got time. We got time to read Thomas Jefferson's article.
Well, that's what I was hoping we would get to as well.
Right. So let's do that. Unless you want to run a commercial.
Hello.
All right. Oh, hi. Okay. Here we go, folks. This is the third and final article. And as I said before, it actually is not an article. It's three quotations from Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist. Before I read them, I want to read a little bit of explanation here. Jefferson believed that Jesus of Nazareth was a mere human being, not the only begotten Son of God. He believed that Jesus was a great teacher of theology and morality. In other words, Jefferson disbelieved in the doctrine of the incarnation. Here comes the first quotation. This comes from a letter to William Short, dated October 31st, 1819. Quote, but the greatest of all reformers of the depraved religion of his own country was Jesus of Nazareth, abstracting what is really his from the rubbish in which it is buried, easily distinguished by its luster from the dross of his biographers, and as separable from that as the diamond from the dunghill, we have the outlines of a system of the most sublime morality which has ever fallen from the lips of man. The establishment of the innocent and genuine character of this benevolent morality and the rescuing it from the imputation of imposture which has resulted from artificial systems invented by ultra-Christian sects, the Immaculate Conception of Jesus, his deification, the creation of the world by him, his miraculous powers, his resurrection and visible ascension, his corporeal presence in the Eucharist, the Trinity, original sin, atonement, regeneration, election, orders of hierarchy, etc., is a most desirable object. End quote. Next quotation. The office of reformer of the superstitions of a nation is ever more dangerous. Jesus had to work on the perilous confines of reason and religion, and a step to the right or left might place him within the grasp of the priests of the superstition, a bloodthirsty race, as cruel and remorseless as the being whom they represented as the family of God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, and the local God of Israel. That Jesus did not mean to impose himself on mankind as the Son of God, physically speaking, I have been convinced by the writings of men more learned than myself in that lore. End quote. And that's a letter written to somebody called Story. I think it's William Story, dated August 4th, 1820. Last quotation. Quote, the truth is that the greatest enemies of the doctrine of Jesus are those calling themselves the expositors of them, who have perverted them to the structure of a system of fancy absolutely incomprehensible without any foundation in his genuine words. And the day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the supreme being as his father, in the womb of a virgin, will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter. End quote. And that's from a letter to John Adams dated April 11th, 1823. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
John Adams, second president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States. They're always running back and forth, and Thomas Jefferson, a president, wrote this to another president, saying,
yeah.
And this is always worth reading again, that the day will come when Jesus is going to be thought of as a myth, just like Minerva being generated in the brain of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Yeah.
I believe it, too. Yeah. Jefferson thought it'd come a lot sooner than it did.
Well, so did Thomas Paine.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, Mark, I'm going to jump off of, you know, you brought up Thomas Paine. I've got some things about what Tom Paine said about Jesus. Now, we know that he wrote in 1794, The Age of Reason. And I love the title of this. It's called The Age of Reason, Being an Investigation of True and a Fabulous Theology. Now, the word fabulous then doesn't mean like it does today. Fabulous!
Right.
No, not that kind of fabulous. It meant incredulous.
I love that word.
You know, incredible.
I love that word.
Unbelievable.
He was so amazing, Thomas Paine.
Yeah. So in the Age of Reason, which you can do a little plug, World Union of Deists, we're one of the very few publishers out there that actually have the whole kit and caboodle of the Age of Reason, all three parts, plus assorted essays and other pieces of material that Thomas Paine wrote. And we have that available on our website for people to purchase as a downloadable ebook, or they can get a hard copy. And all you got to do is go to www.deism.com. In the Age of Reason, Paine, as we've talked about, already professes that he believes in God, but he rejects the world's major religions. He says, I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish church, the Roman church, the Greek church, or the Turk church, or by the Protestant church, nor by any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church. All institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. His main point is that while God is capable of revelation, if that revelation is given to one or a few people only, then no one else is obligated to accept it. He said, revelation to the first person only and hearsay to every other, and consequently, they are not obliged to believe it. And this is the important part about looking at the Gospels and even the whole New Testament, is that it's hearsay. He basically does three things in the Age of Reason, and it does it marvelously. He charges that the legends surrounding Jesus, including the virgin birth, resurrection, are hearsay upon hearsay. Two, he argues that the Christian church sprung out of the tale of heathen mythology. And three, he argues that the Bible, being full of internal problems and being the product of human composition and voting, is, quote, not within the meaning and compass of the word revelation, and therefore is not the word of God, unquote. It's plain and simple. You talk about the heathen mythology. It's very easy because you can take a look and see that Jesus was born of a virgin, born on December 25th, star in the east, 12 disciples, performed miracles, dead for 3 days, and resurrected. Just about every single one of those characteristics I just read can apply to Horus, Attis, Mithra, Dionysus, and even 4 out of the 7 apply to Krishna. All the same story. And so
yeah,
you look at
who was not born of a virgin, huh?
Okay, who?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Superman? I don't know. I'm just saying. I was being sarcastic. Just about,
yeah.
You know, there's like dozens of gods were born of a virgin. Big deal. Even Buddha
exactly.
was born of a virgin.
Well, yeah. See, and that's the whole point. And so the whole idea is that, one, you know, if you have revelation, that's great. That's for you. You only. Anybody else, it'd be like Jason saying, Tim told me, you know, we've done this before, Jason, is that,
Jason, go to Africa.
All right.
Right.
Jason, you tell Mark that God told you to go to Africa, and then Mark can tell me that you told him that God spoke to you. So therefore, we should all listen to what you say. But if he wasn't there,
wait, Tim, God's talking to me right now. Wait,
okay.
God's talking to me right now. God told me for you to give me $10,000. So you know,
okay.
I'll send you my address later. Just send it to me. I'll give you a nice copy of a video and this healing oil.
Hey, Jason, right. since you've got Jesus on the main line there.
I said,
you
God,
know,
not Jesus.
You know, tell him what I want, and I want him to send me an email at tim@deism.com, and I'll be happy to forward you the 10,000 Babel bucks as soon as I can make sure that it was, you know.
I did. I told God that, and God said that God's going to write through me. You're going to get your email, but it'll say Jason X, you know, as
yeah.
a writer.
Yeah, I think one of this is one of my favorite quotes of this is one of my favorite quotes of Tom Paine. It says Jesus Christ wrote no account of himself, of his birth, parentage, or anything else. Not a line of what is called the New Testament is of his writing. The history of him is altogether the work of other people, and as to the account given of his resurrection and ascension, it was the necessary counterpart to the story of his birth. His historians, having brought him into the world in a supernatural manner, were obligated to take him out again in the same manner, or the first part of the story must have fallen to the ground. Bottom line is, Paine, you know, dealing with the virgin birth, it's a miracle. It's impossible to prove or disprove. It's basically that you have a right to believe or not, but it's only hearsay. The New Testament is only hearsay, and that's not any real evidence, period.
True.
Yep.
You know, guys, what do you think of this? What if Jesus was this person who tried to tell the Jewish people that we are all the sons of God, we are a part of God, and we are the sons and daughters of God? And that thought alone, the Jewish people were like, what the heck are you talking about? You're the son of God. That's sacrilege. And he believed it so wholeheartedly that he was on the cross to the very end saying, I really am the son and so are you. He's trying to tell everybody that you're the sons and daughters of God. And somehow, 300 years past his death, you can't control people who really think they're a part of God. They don't have God in their pocket anymore. So they have to kind of twist this Christian faith that has been, you know, kind of taking hold on the people because people are starting to really think, wow, I'm a part of God. I'm a part of nature and the creation. What do you think?
Well, Marky,
Jesus...
you know, if Jesus did teach that,
mm-hmm.
that's wonderful. If he was a heretical Jewish rabbi in the first century, as we common era, as or you know, we deal with now. If he really did exist and he did that kind of thing and he had a completely different take on who Jehovah was and how he was supposed to be, maybe he was influenced by the Essenes and the Qumran community there by the Dead Sea. You know, it doesn't make any difference. You know,
no,
because
I
we're all it's all speculating
right.
as to what this is. Here's the thing that gets to me is that what's most revealing of all is not what people wrote about Jesus and all this plethora of manuscripts and so-called stories and everything. It's what people did not write about him. You got to consider that not one single historian, philosopher, scribe, or follower who lived before or during the alleged time of Jesus ever mentions him. It's always people afterwards, based on hearsay that they heard.
Right.
And then they're reporting the hearsay that they heard. And you can go all the way down to, you know, you can go Tacitus, you can go Josephus, you can Pliny the Younger. You know, it doesn't make any difference. It's all quoting somebody else who
right.
said that this is something that happened.
Right.
And there's, I think the thing that really gets me, one of the things that really got to me when I was doing some study on this is that I came across the concept that, you know, we've heard the story that he's a carpenter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the word that was translated is tecton, and that just means builder. And the interesting thing is that carpentry was far and in between. It was actually stonework that was used mostly for building back then at Jesus' time and place. And so to translate tecton into carpenter is hermeneutically unsound because they don't take into account the time and the existence of the people, the culture at the time. Most likely he was a stonemason.
He was, oh yeah, he's a mason.
Wait, hold on here. Joseph was a stonemason. I don't believe Jesus' occupation is mentioned. Jesus was the son of Joseph.
That's right.
You, Joseph. You were doing abduction, sir.
There you go. Well, no, I was talking about what is the common belief, the common story. I was just speaking in that respect. Not that I believe he was actually a stonemason. Besides, you know, carrying stones, that's pretty hard to walk on water, you know, with the stones.
Yeah.
So, you know, really what I'm just trying to get across is that it's not unusual for those of us who have been so thoroughly indoctrinated by our culture and by our religious history to almost not even question the accuracy or the reliability of the Gospels, which are the four primary biographies. If you want to look at the writings that were discovered at the Nag Hammadi Library, actually coincidentally the same time that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the caves around the Dead Sea in Qumran, we find the Gnostic teachings, and we find some of these other Gospels. You know, we got the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Peter, the
Judas.
Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Judas, as well as the Gospel of Thomas.
Right.
And all these provide slightly different viewpoints. And the reason they were buried was because they were not orthodox. They were considered to be heresy. And that, and we know a lot of these books were burned. Irenaeus, who is one of the church fathers, so to speak, wrote in his treatise on heresy, he wrote about the Gnostics. Well, turns out the guy lied, because the Gnostics, the books that were discovered in, I think it was 1948, completely dispute Irenaeus's viewpoint on what Gnostics were. So not only we got church fathers that also lied about
and I read that email you sent me, and in that email St. John Chrysostom says it's all right to lie to promote the gospel. And,
yeah, I heard
oh,
that.
Yeah,
Martin
so did
Luther.
Martin Luther and Loyola.
And the third one? Loyola?
Ignatius
yeah.
Loyola
so,
and Martin Luther. Martin Luther
so
said,
excuse me, sir. You got an Eastern Orthodox, a Roman Catholic, and a Protestant, quote-unquote, saint, and also church
yeah.
father, telling Christians, it's okay to lie to spread the gospel, which
yep.
makes me think that maybe the whole thing was a lie. You know, lie upon lie upon lie.
Yeah, it's the scariest part of all this, too, is that when you start to study some of the actual historians of the time, like Philo Judaeus, who lived contemporaneous with Jesus, lived at the time. He wrote detailed accounts of the Jewish events that occurred in Judea, in that area. And not once in all of his volumes is there a single account of a Yeshua, a Joshua, a Jesus, the so-called Christ. We don't find any mention of Jesus in Seneca's writings, nor in Pliny the Elder. So, you know, where was he? What are you going to do?
He didn't make enough of an impact. You know, you figure it's a guy who feeds thousands just has not been impressive.
Yeah. We have not one Jewish, Greek, or Roman writer. Those that lived in the Middle East during the same time that Jesus supposedly existed, who ever mentioned him during his supposed lifetime. Nothing. He's absent. He's gone. He's not there. And the other thing is, supposedly, Jesus, you know, made such a big impact because the Gospels portray a look let's see here. Herod claims that he had heard of the fame of Jesus, Matthew 14:1. Matthew 4:25 claims that there followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee and from Decapolis and from Jerusalem and from Judea and from beyond the Jordan. The Gospels mention countless times the great multitudes that followed him, the crowds of people who congregated to hear him, so crowded sometimes that in Luke 12:1, an innumerable multitude of people trod upon each other. You had trampolings of so many people. Why didn't that get mentioned anywhere in the contemporaneous non-biblical historians that existed at the time?
Well, I'd like to say for the record that I still believe Jesus was a real person who got mythologized, but And when I first heard people say Jesus didn't exist, I thought, oh, that's just, you know, overcompensation against Christianity. But the more I study this stuff, the more I think, okay, that's not stupid. Thomas Paine believed it. My opinion on the matter is that probably what happened is that Jesus was not a great miracle worker. He was just an ordinary human being. But stories evolved about him, and so eventually, long after he was dead, lots of people believe that he walked on water and he changed water into wine and did that stuff. That's my abductive.
Well, and they do this throughout history, Jason. You're
yeah.
right. And they do this through. Look at Thomas Paine, for example. It's almost, I can give you material, and we should do a show on this one day, that Thomas Paine is the author, the architect of the Declaration of Independence. You have three deists, pure deists, Franklin, Jefferson, and Paine. And Paine is the original drafter, and I've got great material that proves 99.9% that Thomas Paine is the author, but it definitely proves that Jefferson was not the author. So
very interesting.
I'd be interested to see that. You can send it to me when you have a chance.
I've got a book, Joseph Lewis is the first book, and I've got a link that is an awesome lecture by an Andrew Gabbana or something like that I can send you guys. It's a 6-hour lecture where he talks about the revolution and what happened.
Well, I could actually see that possibility in that Paine's ideas and his concepts could be attributed. I don't know if
what if you could the material I sent you, what if you knew for sure or 99.9, because none of us were there. But what if you knew, what if you, I could show you material that would say, wow, Jefferson definitely didn't write it. So in Payne, if you, all the characters involved, Payne is in every scenario with the
I find that interesting, but that would contradict two bibliographies that I read. I read a biography of John Adams, and I read a biography of Thomas Jefferson. And in both those biographies, John Adams is saying Thomas Jefferson wrote it. And Thomas Jefferson says, I wrote it. And in fact, on his tombstone, he wanted
to
be
remembered. Well, we also have the similarity to the
Declaration of Independence.
Well,
yeah, we also have the similarity to the document that was done in for the colony of Virginia as well. But I'm not going to, you know, I would love to see that stuff, Mark. You know, what it makes me think of, though, is maybe just my concluding point is that it would be like telling people that Abraham Lincoln didn't exist and we couldn't find any mention of him in the 19th century. Whatsoever. But we do in the 21st century because I saw a movie, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. And
I'm thinking
that might actually be the true story.
Yeah, it's funny. It's how people change. How they change people, like through history, how a person can be changed. Like Jason, I kind of agree that Jesus was a character, but, you know, it doesn't matter one way or the other to me, but I lean towards he was real because all the books that I've read kind of say that he was real. But, you know, the things, you know, that he was a born of a virgin and all this other stuff, of course, I don't believe that. And what I'm getting at with the whole Thomas Paine thought with the Declaration of Independence is how history does change people. They,
sure.
Look what the George Washington, the father of
the country. Oh, absolutely.
When you realize that Thomas Paine is the actual author, and one need only Google the original draft of the Declaration of Independence, which is in John Adams' handwriting, and it's copied word for word from somebody. And Jefferson has this one also that Jefferson has. It's in his handwriting. Both are exactly the same, but the original draft talks about slavery, and of course Jefferson had slavery, and if Jefferson was the actual writer, he would be the biggest hypocrite because he owned slaves. And if you read the original draft and all they cut out, because it's beautiful in its original draft, if we would have kept with the original draft, we wouldn't have had a civil war. We wouldn't have had a
four score and however many years later.
You know?
What? Yeah.
And proving that, you know, we're... Especially, we put a lot of credence in Thomas Paine for good reason. His writings, political and theological, are going to run the test of time, and he's finally going to get at least a street named after him, I should hope. You know, or at least something in Washington that proclaims this awesome world hero.
Well, only if we have a regime change. Because right now, they're a bunch of authoritarian fascists.
Yeah, I hear you there. I do agree. I mean, I know we're getting off the subject of Jesus.
Well, we're almost out of time anyway.
Yeah,
so.
actually, I think this is a good point to wrap up the show. I want to thank my co-host, Tim Wingate, and I want to thank Mark for calling in. Feel free to email me at jason@deism.com. That's jason@deism.com. Please join us again on the first Monday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, and 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And remember that God gave us reason, not religion.
Hope you enjoyed this presentation. To learn more about deism, please visit www.deism.com. That's deism.com. and visit GodDiscussion.com for the latest church and state news, articles, and opinions. The comments and opinions in this broadcast are respected, but do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of other hosts, guests, and/or GodDiscussion.com.
Frightening number of Americans think that man coexisted with dinosaurs 6,000 years ago, where church and state are headed for a collision course. You've got one new source that covers it all. GodDiscussion.com. Go there, comment, bookmark it, spread the word, engage. GodDiscussion.com.